Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Charlie Barnett, and I'm a senior producer here at the IAI.
And I'm Ricky, production lead here at the IAI.
Today we've got The Seduction of Thought, featuring best-selling author Miranda Keeling, psychologist Steve Taylor, and prison philosopher Andy West. This took place in the 2022 How the Light Gets In Festival in London, the philosophy festival produced by the team here at the IAI. So, Ricky, tell us a bit more about the debate.
Well, this debate explored whether words, thought, and kind of logic were giving us insights into reality or maybe standing in the way of reality. A lot of our experience is kind of mediated by our ideas about things, our concepts, but maybe this is actually standing in the way. The way we feel about things, how our body feels in the presence of certain things, that can actually give us way more insight than just thinking alone.
So is the idea that our knowledge is not a holistic understanding of the world and the way in which we represent that knowledge through language is a very limited view?
I think not only that, I think Steve Taylor even argues that knowledge might actually stand in the way even of us having a true picture of reality. That's one view, but I mean, obviously thinking, intellectual thought, that's obviously had a huge impact on our culture and allows us to do so many different things. So it feels dangerous to kind of get rid of thought altogether.
So if you enjoy today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's now hand over to the host of this debate, Jana Teller.
From the birth of reason to Descartes, I think therefore I am. Western culture has placed thought at the center of what it is to be human. In our everyday lives, the same is true. We spend much of our time planning the future, reflecting on the past, puzzling about what to do, and talking about it with others. But might this be a mistake? To think too much is a disease, argued Dostoevsky. While existentialists made the case that thought obscures the essence of what it is to be a human being. Should culture, as Nietzsche proposes, free itself from the seduction of words and thought? Should we focus on experience, action, and being, turn off our screens, explore the world, and live a bit more? Or is this romantic nonsense and thought not only makes us unique, but allows us to make sense of the world and alone offers the means to overcome the profound challenges we face? So on to our speakers. On my very left here, I have Miranda Keeling, is a writer, actor, filmmaker, and winner of the BBC's Norman Beaton Radio Drama Award. She's the author of The Year I Stopped to Notice. And then we have Steve Taylor, author of several best-selling books in the fields of psychology and spirituality, and is a senior lecturer in psychology. And to my right, we have Andy West, who has taught philosophy in prison since 2015, and recently wrote his first book, The Life Inside, which explores the conversations he had with those prisoners and his own family connection to prison. Please give a warm welcome to the panel. We start off, we have a lot of things to cover today, so we go straight into the pitch where each of the speakers will give a 3-minute introduction of their thoughts on the issue and the main question, which is, should culture free itself from the seduction of words and thought? And I will let Steve Taylor start. And I'm tough on time, Steve, so.
Okay, I'll bear that in mind. Good morning, everybody. I'm on the side of Dostoevsky and Nietzsche. It sounds a bit pretentious, but I disagree with Descartes. Again, that's something I thought I'd never say. But I think the kind of self which is associated with thinking is a kind of superficial, even illusory type of self. I think our real authentic self, or more authentic self, more essential self, emerges when we stop thinking, in moments when our mind is quiet and empty. But it's important to bear in mind, I think, you know, you can broadly speaking, you can differentiate between two different types of thinking. There is what you could call rational, conscious thought, which you use to evaluate things, to critically analyze things. We use it to plan, to decide, to organize, and so forth. And that's obviously a great tool. It's a great, you know, it's one of the great advantages of being human, that we can use this conscious thought. But unfortunately, I don't think much of our thought is actually of that type. I think probably 95% of thought, well, maybe I'm talking about my own mind here, this is obviously the one I know best. 95% of our thinking tends to be kind of random, associational, involuntary chatter. It's kind of the stream of consciousness, you could call it. It tends to focus on the future, the past, daydreams about alternate realities. And it stops us being present, and it creates a kind of filter that stands between us and reality, like a fog of abstraction, which stops us really experiencing the world around us. It can stop us really communicating with one another, because there's so much sort of random chatter in our minds that we don't really communicate fully, or we're not really present to other people. So it would be great if we could increase the amount of rational conscious thought we have and decrease the amount of chatter that we have. Also, this chatter tends to gravitate towards negative things, tends to gravitate towards worries, problems, resentments. It tends to inflate them, so it can cause quite a lot of discord in our lives. And I think most of the really happy moments, the happiest moments in our lives, arise when we stop thinking. In psychology, there's a concept called flow that you've probably heard of, which is when our minds are intensely absorbed in an activity and a stimulating activity, and our minds become very quiet. There's a sense of energetic fullness within us, a sense of energy, a sense of well-being, and also meditation. You know, meditation, the very aim of many types of meditation is to empty the mind, to stop thinking. And when we do that, we feel this marvelous kind of rich energy inside, this marvelous fullness of being. So it would be great if thinking could be a tool that we sort of pick up when we need it. And when we don't need it, we can put it down again and enjoy a kind of a mental emptiness, mental quietness, which would give us a more authentic and essential sense of identity.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. And then Miranda Keeling.
So as an actor, I found myself kind of writing a script. But it's interesting what you just said about flow, because that's what I'm going to start with. And I'd like to kind of second a lot of what you've said. So as an artist, I know really well the feeling of being in flow. You know, when that happens, all thoughts kind of fall away, and it's an indescribable feeling that it happens, especially when I'm creating something, so a story or some writing or a recording. And I've experienced this feeling of being in flow, not just when I'm creating something, so in terms of culture, but also when I'm swimming or, you know, doing yoga or listening to music. And on stage, I've felt the flow of energy from an audience, and I've thrown it back at them, all before we've had a moment to even form a thought. And it's a wonderful experience. And some people call this flow God, and some people call it something else, and some people have no idea what it is, right? But when I meditate, as you mentioned, meditation, I reach a similar place where I'm resting with the contents of my mind. And I notice my thoughts, but importantly, I'm not pulled along by them. I can sense the space kind of underneath my thoughts, the emptiness, and I can rest there. And it can feel blissful. So there is an enormous amount of benefit in being without thought, especially while creating art, which is culture. However, there is still a place for thought. I used to work in improvised theater. I was in a company of four actors, and we used to have to go all night, on stage every night, and improvise two plays with an interval in between, an hour long each. And before each show, the audience would vote on who we were and where we were. So they might say, you're three bridesmaids and a bride in a kitchen. And then the director would come back and tell us, and we'd look through our costumes and put something relevant on and come out and improvise this play. So the reason I tell you about this is that improvised theatre is an extreme form of present culture. What happens every night is brand new. It's happening right now, and it can never be repeated. But there were rules, and some of you might be familiar with the rules of improvisation, you know, accept what's offered, that kind of thing. And those rules have been considered and devised over a long time, and they work. My background before acting was in circus and magic and escapology, and they all require, you know, dexterity and quick thinking, quick reactions. And they also require hours of practice and thought. The magician Tommy Cooper, I don't know if you know Tommy Cooper, but he had this signature kind of comedy magic act. And he put huge amounts of thought into producing what looked like a chaotic off-the-cuff character. So there is a freedom away from the seduction of thought. And when you dip your paintbrush into paint and you splash it against the canvas, you know, that's a relinquishing of control. And artistically, it's really valuable. But thought enables us to communicate and to create collectively and to learn from our mistakes and successes and to plan our next piece of work. Thought is often what enables those producing culture to enjoy the thoughtlessness of being in flow.
Thank you. And Andy?
So should culture avoid the seduction of words and thought? I think we should make words and thought more seductive than they are at the moment. There's an experience I had earlier this year in February, which has really stuck with me. I was in a woman's prison where I'd been teaching for a while, and I had a relatively new class. And I was filling up my whiteboard with the theory of moral consequentialism, this idea that an action is good or bad depending on the outcomes that it has, rather than depending on a religious framework or whether because of some system of reason and ideas. I was explaining this theory of consequentialism, and one of the women in the class just had this huge grin on her face. And I was kind of aware of it. I was a bit distracted by it, but I was kind of carried on anyway in earnest, kind of explaining this theory. And then she just started laughing. And I said, "What's up?" Her name was Ari. And I said, "What's up?" And she said, "So people actually sit down and write out all this kind of stuff about what makes something good or bad?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's kind of what philosophers do. That's the study of philosophy. That's the practice of philosophy." And she just laughed again and said, "But so you're telling me they actually do that, like, as a thing?" And she said, "Isn't it just like childhood, though, that kind of makes you who you are, and like where you're born, and then that's kind of just how you turn out to be?" And I found it really moving, actually, that kind of almost like naked confession of like fatalism and determinism. And obviously that had been perhaps part of her life, the fact that she'd ended up in prison. It also kind of made sense given the kind of layer of society she was in. Prisons are not a world that are touched by good sense most of the time. I think we all know, most of society know, most politicians know, most policymakers know what would make that world better, what would improve it. They know which ideas work, they know which ideas don't work, but the actual public will or political courage to actually make those improvements just don't happen. So it's not a surprise that in that setting, big ideas become quite literally laughable. But, you know, I sort of carried on in earnest with Ari, and we had a great 3 months together, and I think she really enjoyed the class. I suppose my feeling with a student like that is it doesn't have to be this way. And, you know, there is a history in the working class of like of education and ideas and thought and intellectual enrichment, what got called the mutual improvement societies that you'd have, where mill workers or factory workers would gather together and pool resources to build libraries and teach each other bits they'd learned from politics, literature, art, ethics. What was called bettering yourself. I think those movements were the things that that gave rise to the labor movement, that they were part of a sort of organized working class. They didn't come out of philanthropy, that those libraries weren't given from above. They weren't state funded. And so what I want is more of that, that those kind of movements couldn't really exist today in the age of the 0 hours contract and in the age of the Uber driver and in the age where certain companies make it illegal for you to join unions. But I suppose when I think of this question of culture, should culture avoid the seduction of thought? You know, what do we mean by culture? Are we talking capital C culture, or are we talking society in general? And I think in society in general, I'd love to see more thought, because that's what makes another existence possible. That's what makes, if you can think, if you can imagine another possible existence for yourself, then that's what can free you. One of the things that can free you from the kind of fatalism that Ari had.
Interesting, thank you. Andy, we'll hold that thought. We'll get back to, I think, that with a thought kind of help us change our lives later. We'll now get into our first theme, and you can also get back to what you've been saying in your statements, if that fits in here. Is thought a distraction from or a description of reality? And I want to start with Miranda on that.
So, to sum up my answer, I would say that it is a description. I have thoughts about whether it's distracting, thought in itself, but I think that every thought that we have is a description of our understanding of reality in that moment. It's not necessarily a thought that keeps us present, like I am cold or whatever. It might be I'm worried about this thing that I'm doing next week, or it might be a thought that's not based in actual reality at all because we're feeling confused or, I don't know, drunk or whatever. But it's always a description of our understanding of reality.
But aren't there thoughts that like come out of, you can say nowhere, in a sense, what the flow you were talking about before, when you're in that moment,
yeah,
there's still thought.
Yes.
I mean, otherwise you couldn't communicate.
Yes.
So those thoughts become part of your flow. Are they then still describing? And are they describing, from which point of view are they describing?
So when I talk about being in flow, I don't feel like I have any thought at all. I feel like in that moment, it's like there's a force flowing through me from somewhere into something. So there is no thought there. But when I am having a thought, whatever that thought is, it's a way of describing my lived reality, either in the past, now, or in the future.
Right, so you also thought as a description. I think I want to have Steve come in on that.
I think it can be both. I think a lot of the time it can be a distraction from reality. You know, daydreams, for example, are not reality, and they can stand in the way of reality. They can prevent you becoming aware of the reality that you're in this moment. I think one of the great sort of themes of spiritual traditions, which is one of my interests, is that they try to get beyond thought, and they try to get to a kind of perception or experience which is non-conceptual, non-lingual. That's one of the great ideas of Zen Buddhism, for example. It's about, it's a way of kind of recapturing children's perception. Young children live in a kind of pre-lingual, pre-conceptual world. And that's why the world is so incredibly exhilarating real to them. You know, we all know, if anybody's got young children, you all know that they have this amazingly vivid, intense perception. Everything is fascinating, you know, even the most mundane things, crisp packets, you know, dog poo on the path, anything they find is fascinating. But we lose that as we become older, because we start to develop a kind of conceptual mind. We start to think in terms of concepts, and the concepts stand in the way of reality. If you think of the concept of a tree, or the word tree, you know, it doesn't capture the reality of these strange, fantastical, living organisms that we see in our gardens and our streets. It doesn't capture it at all. And if you reduce it to the word tree, you miss so much of it. You know, so if you forget the concept, forget the word, and if you're confronted with the reality of a tree or anything, it's so much more, it's so much more real.
But would you claim then that in a wordless world there would be no thinking? Or wouldn't we just, you know, think without that kind of concepts?
Well, lots of kind of non-linguistic cultures in the world who don't have written language, and some indigenous groups, and they obviously still have thought.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So, mm-hmm. so they, and even if they might not use a word like tree for a tree, still the recognition of the existence of that plant group as a tree is there. So,
yeah.
So there's somehow must be a communication around it. It'll still enter thought at some level.
Yeah, I agree, but you can still, even if you have a language, you can still recognize something beyond language. You can still sort of enter a state of consciousness in which you see the reality of things beyond language.
Yeah.
You know, which is like one of the aims of meditation, is to kind of deconstruct those concepts and those psychological processes which create concepts and language.
So you think that when words are used to describe, and thereby you can say in a way thought are used to describe the world, it actually takes us away from being in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
That's what I think.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. So I want to move on to Andy on this, because I imagine you have a different perspective on that thing, you know, when you were talking about how thought is necessary to make any changes in the world. And your prison world must or work must also have confront you with people who need daydreaming even to get through their existence. But what is your take on whether thought is a distraction or description from reality?
Well, I guess my first thought on that is how would we know? I don't think any of us have been able to look at reality independently of ourselves. What do we know what reality is like and whether our thoughts and our mind are distorting it or not? We're just lumbered in this skull, and we have to look at everything through these eyes, and take everything in through this brain. So, in terms of, you know, I can see how flow states, meditation, that kind of thing, I can see how it can give you a heightened sense of perception, of beauty, of joy, of many life-affirming things. But I don't know if that's reality as such. I don't know if that's the way that things are in themselves. I don't know if that's the sort of numinous, as Kant called it.
Yeah. Do you think that we get closer or further away to the understanding of reality when we put words and concepts on them? You know, like what Steve was saying, that takes us away from reality. But isn't there also a way one could imagine the opposite is actually that the more we're able to discern, and by putting words and concepts on each little part of reality,
yes,
the more we see and understand?
I suppose, just to put my sort of society hat back on, which I kind of opened with, I suppose there's something potentially troubling about the idea of switching off thought. You know, part of the reason I teach philosophy in prisons is or part of what has been really rewarding about it is seeing people just find more descriptions, find more language, find more ways to reveal what their own life and their own circumstance is like to them, and how it could be in the future. So, you know, while there's definitely a place to, there's definitely a time and place to let go of neurotic thinking, obsessive thinking, an overly analytical mode in life, I think when you sort of look at that from a society point of view, what I want is more thought. I don't think that's a distraction. I think that's clarifying. I think ideas can be, it can be incredibly, illuminating.
Right. Yeah, so thoughts and conceptualization actually expands the personal understanding of reality.
Yes. And yeah.
Yeah. And can I just get quickly in on that from the other side here?
It's so interesting. So meditation's an interesting subject here, because in terms of what, you know, Andy was talking about, and I think Steve, you might agree that when you meditate, you're not, the thoughts that come up aren't all positive. It isn't all about resting in the joy and the kind of loveliness, because a lot of what comes up in meditation makes you cry or deal with the really difficult things, because you've given them space. Often we cover them with a lot of stuff. So I do think that, especially through having meditated for a long time, that thoughts can be a distraction. They can be a distraction that is positive, it could be negative, it could be neutral. But I still think that if you come back to the question, what are those thoughts? Are they a distraction or a description? they're a description. So they distract you, yes, but they distract you with a description of your reality. And coming back quickly to dreams, yeah, I might be dreaming, I might be having thoughts of, while I'm asleep, about swimming through a river dressed as a dolphin, and that's not real, but it's a description of my reality in the dream. So I think it's always kind of, yeah, I think I come back to the same.
Right. I just want to get Steve in this, but I also want to, if we sat meditating all the time, wouldn't that take us away from reality rather than bring us closer to it?
I don't think so. I think the opposite. You know, anybody who's meditated, one thing I often get after a good meditation, because a lot of meditations are not very good, and again, speaking personally.
Same.
Because, yeah, sometimes it's because of thought. You get too many thoughts in your mind. You just can't focus on your breathing or whatever. But even that's kind of, that's interesting in itself, because you do start to observe your thinking, and you get a sense of distance between yourself and your thoughts. But what I meant to say was that after a good meditation, my perceptions become so much richer. I notice things. I notice a pattern on the cup. I think, wow, was that pattern really there all these years on this cup? The pattern's on a shirt. Wow, look at that pattern on the shirt. My perception becomes so intense, a bit like children's perception again. So if we could cultivate that kind of perception on an ongoing basis, we would live much closer to reality. The world would become much more real to us. And we'd also have better relationships with each other, because a lot of discord in relationships comes from not being present, you know, or comes from expectations which are future-based, or resentments which are past-based from the past. But if you're fully present to somebody without future or the past and without distracting thoughts, then there's a new harmony in relationships. You know, there's a sense of presence and sense of respect.
Yeah. But then you're getting up to that. The problem is the distracting thought. It's not thought as such.
Yeah, I agree. You know, in its place, I think thought is fantastic. It's one of the greatest human tools and attributes. But it's just this kind of distracting associational chatter, which seems to be an affliction which we human beings have to bear.
Yeah. Do you want to just come in on some of this before we move to the next theme? Or
I agree with Steve in that I don't want to make it a false antithesis, you know, between thinking and not thinking, that you're sort of either with them or with us, obviously, that there's benefits in both, and yeah.
Okay, let's move to the next theme. Are modern humans too lost in the distraction of everyday thought? Should we turn off our screens and live a bit more? And I mean, these days everyone seems to be addicted to a phone. Very happy to see that most people are looking up here to the stage, not looking on their phones. but half of our lives are spent staring at screens, actually. And are modern humans too lost in that distraction, the distraction of everyday thoughts? Should we turn off our screens? And I guess that is meant in a broader sense, and live a bit more. Andy, what is your take on that?
So one of the reasons another reason I quite like my working day in prison is that you cannot take a mobile phone or any kind of device into prison. So I have to put it in a locker before I go in. And, you know, for the first 5 minutes of the day, I'm often like bereft, you know, every time I check my pocket and where are my alerts? And there's kind of withdrawal. But you kind of really enjoy the day, like you get your attention span back because it's not being like pillaged by like pings and emails. But one of the uneasy ironies of that is that smartphones in prison are illegal and therefore sell at a very, very high price. So, you know, a smartphone that you could buy for £250 on eBay for, you could sell for £2,000 in prison. And often people secrete smartphones in their anuses. And so I'm sort of walking up the stairs in Pentonville, enjoying the absence of weight in my pocket. And I know that maybe the man who's crossing the stairs with me has a phone in his ass. So it's one of the sort of ironies.
It doesn't ring.
Yeah. So yeah, it's one of those ironies in that I'm like, oh, it's so nice to be free from my phone and all that contact and nobody can get to me. But obviously, you know, there's people in there who are disconnected in the worst possible way and will take huge risks and do crazy things and, you know, financial risks, legal risks, physiological risks just to get a phone.
And in like a philosophical context, do you think that that's because the phone represent a connection to reality for them, you know, existential reality, or is it more practical? It's a way to make deals and to get contact with their family, or is it kind of both?
Yeah, I think both. Yeah, I mean, occasionally you just, you know, I'm working in Brixton at the moment, HMP Brixton, with a group of lifers, and you know, they've been in, some of them have been in 16, 17 years already, and they're just sort of past, they're just past it with smartphones. It's just, you know, maybe they would have done that 10 years ago or whatever, but it's just not something they're interested in. And I think part of the reason that is their survival strategy is a lot about what gets called on the landing, keep your head in jail, and then you can survive this. Whereas if your head's outside, if you're sort of entangled in outside life too much, then inside life is not so survivable.
So, yeah. Interesting. I think, Steve, we'll get you in here. We talk about your phones and screens, but did that kind of loss of sense of reality not start much earlier than 20 years ago? I mean, what do we talk about with television, with books, with, you know, that thing of leaving yourself in another thought?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I can remember the pre-internet days on trains. You go on a train and everyone was either reading a book or staring out the window or talking. And now everyone's looking at a screen. So, that, you know, you seem to have lost something of, you know, even that sense of connection to the countryside, that, you know, you stare out the train window and you see lovely countryside rolling by, but people have lost that. I also remember as a child, you know, walking down the street, if you walk down a terrace house, a street of terrace houses near where I live, everybody would be sitting in the front room watching TV, sort of staring in a trance-like state, a picture box in the corner of the room. I thought, wait, what's going on here? Why do they need to do that? But I think a lot of human beings do find it very difficult to be present. We instinctively search for, you know, an object to focus our attention on to get us away from the state of being present.
And why is that? Is that our lives are somehow so horrid? You know, even in...
I think a lot of it's acclimatization. A lot of people are just not used to spending time inside their own minds or beings. That they're so used to focusing their attention outside that they almost never focus their attention inwardly. And if they do focus their attention immediately, there's a sense of restlessness, that kind of restless associational thought chatter is on our mind. So it feels a bit uneasy. So it's like a house. Imagine a house where there's a lot of discord, where the family are always arguing. So the child wants to spend most of the time outside the house. It's a bit like that with our own minds, because there's a sense of discord. We want to spend our time outside our minds.
So we almost get, it's almost like an addiction that we need to get outside of our minds.
Exactly, and it becomes habitual. You know, once a habit creates itself, it's very difficult to, I mean, I get it, sometimes I get up in the morning, go downstairs, and immediately there's an urge to fix my attention somewhere, like a newspaper, check my email, rather than just being present and enjoying the situation, enjoying my breakfast. So it's a habit, you know.
So you think it's a habit, it's not necessarily inherent in the human being that we seek that, you know, distraction outside us. It's somehow that something we are brought up to have in our cultures.
I think it's an instinctive reaction to our own sort of discord, to a sense of unease within ourselves, but it becomes habitual and it's encouraged by our culture as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to move on to Miranda. Do you think also that we are distracted too much, of course, through all the screens, but is that where is reality then?
That's an interesting question. I think we are distracted too much by screens. I completely agree with you, Andy, that when I don't have my phone on me, it's initially weird and I feel jumpy, and then I just go, oh, thank goodness. And reality is both out here and in this, the entire world copied again in our phones. So we're stuck somewhere in the middle, I think. And you were talking about, although it's nice to be without your phone, actually, it's for some people in the prisons you go into, it's incredibly serious whether or not they have a phone. And you only have to think about, you know, Molly Russell in this Instagram case to be reminded that these devices are really, they can be used for good, they can be used for being in flow, doing a yoga class, blah, 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 right? But the algorithms are designed to pull us somewhere else, and they're very competent at doing that. So we're fighting, because I was thinking about the question, are modern humans too lost in the distraction of everyday thoughts? Because, you know, Buddha was teaching about distracting thoughts 2,500 years ago. So it's not a modern situation. But I think that the devices that we have and the software and the algorithms and the things that we're up against with these screens, it is different, it is modern, and it is both potentially joyous and potentially incredibly damaging.
Yeah, it seems somehow that the modern technology has like made all what was already there distracting from ourselves exponentially much worse, and it's like every year going worse, and they know all our weaknesses to prey into this. But when we still see somebody who is incarcerated, because I think it's an actually really interesting example then of what it is to be a human being. If you sit in a cell, and particularly if you then imagine somebody in isolation or alone in a cell, that phone is the only communication with the outside world. But it also then, if it were a smartphone, becomes the impression of what the world is, because how we perceive the world depends on what we take in. And I don't know how you see that, if that changes then people's perception of reality in prisons depending on whether they have a smartphone or not. I mean, you must have talked to prisoners both who have one and who don't have one. How is their perception and sense of their own being and reality?
I think if they do have one, they certainly shouldn't tell me about it, because I would have to report it.
So officially you don't know.
Officially I don't know about it. And in terms of talking sort of their experience and their reality, I suppose I have to be, honest about the fact that I go home at 5 o'clock. I've never been behind the door. I've never been incarcerated myself. My brother and my dad and my uncle were, and I have a lot of family who were, but I've never actually had that experience myself. But I think the separation from reality for prisoners comes via the sensation of time that a lot of prisoners say. It's when you get out, even if you've been watching the telly and reading the newspapers and you've been keeping up to date with society or whatever, it's just the tempo of existence. It just hurtles right past you in a way that, if you've just had this life of docility and waiting and boredom in prison for years and years and years, you've just slowed so much without realizing
that.
Yeah,
I mean, in a way it links up with a meditation the few people who seem to have managed to get something positive out of prison, I'm not a believer in prison at all, but the very few that we know publicly, like figures like a Mandela or a Malcolm X or so, they somehow manage, I guess, to use that forced meditative slow way of living into finding another path as the only way to survive. Would you think that?
Well, Malcolm X is an interesting case for our debate, because he gave himself to the seduction of thought and words. He copied out the entire dictionary in his prison cell. He became a fierce autodidact. He read and read and read, and it was that, he read world history, he read black history, he read about politics, economics, and it was that allowed him a view on where he was, how he got there, who he was, and who he could be.
I've also, sorry, can you just come in there? I've done quite a lot of research on transformational experience in prisoners. I've done a lot of research on transformational experiences in the midst of psychological turmoil and difficult situations, and I found that quite a few prisoners who I interviewed, they mentioned this sort of letting go, that they had to let go of their identity, because everything which constitutes your identity is outside the prison walls. So you have to sort of let go of who you thought you were, which is very painful for a lot of people. But for some people, it seems to bring out a more essential identity. They find something deeper within themselves. And I think that's a kind of an analogy for what happens to anybody when they enter their own being, when we stop distracting ourselves and really learn to occupy our own mental space and to explore our own mental space, we find something, deeper and more authentic.
Yeah, it's a bit like that enforced meditative state. I mean, some people manage to get something good out of that COVID isolation.
I was just going to say, it's not comparable exactly, but I was wondering if it's a bit like what you're talking about when we were sort of imprisoned. It's not the same, but, by the virus and by the rules. Yeah. And time did change. My relationship to time and how I felt about it really did change.
Yeah, that thing that there are not that many outside demands, yeah. Because part of all that distraction is not only coming from our thoughts, but does come from what the outside world from us.
Yeah.
How do you look at that, Steve?
I agree. I get it. It goes back to sort of the illusory or kind of delusory quality of thought that it can create a kind of false image of who you are based on other people's impressions or based on your own thoughts. So you can develop a whole thought created identity, which is not your real self. And it's when you're in a situation like prison or when you spend a lot of time alone, a kind of enforced solitude, then you find out what is beneath thoughts. You find a more essential identity. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why traumatic situations I found in my research, they can be very beneficial because they allow people to go beneath their kind of thought-created identity and find something more fundamental and more essential.
So as I hear coming out, it's not so much whether your thoughts are good or bad, but there are different levels of thoughts. There are thoughts that are distracting, but there are thoughts that are needed to make change. There are thoughts that are needed to reach ourselves. Miranda, do you want to give some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was thinking about this because in the question that says, are modern humans too lost in the distraction of everyday thoughts? And I started thinking, well, what is an everyday thought? Is it every day because it repeats? Is it every day because it's about something unimportant? You know, how do we rank thought? Should we rank thought? And how is it useful to us?
I think we have to. You know, some thought thinking is, like I said before, thinking can be a great tool, but it can also be, an enemy. Not an enemy, that's too
but
strong,
I mean,
but
is,
it can be problematic.
Are we being distracted from everyday thought, or are we just being distracted in general?
Well, everyday thought, I guess, isn't that necessary? I mean, if you need to buy the milk, you have to think, how do you get to the store to buy the milk?
Well, that's good. I used to go and see a spiritual teacher in Manchester for many, many, many years. He was a very wise, kind of enlightened guy. And somebody said to me once, Ian, do you think, is your mind sort of busy? And he said, yeah, I have some thoughts, but most of the time my mind is kind of empty. It's just full of experience. So somebody said, what are your thoughts? And he said, I have about 5 or 6 thoughts a day.
Huh? Okay, so that's a nice one.
That's a good thing to aim for.
Okay, I think we'll go to our last theme of the day. That will thought always be the defining quality of being human? I mean, we've just been speaking about, people leaving their own mind and being with the screen and so. And at least I spend a lot of time with animals. And the wonderful thing with animals is they don't do that. They are in themselves, at least to my knowledge. We can't fully know, but I have never seen an animal that distracted that it didn't deal with reality. Are we a misfit somehow that we shouldn't even be? Because we lost that we got too distracted. We got too many brain waves somehow that we get addicted to being outside ourselves. It's somehow, I mean, if God or Big Bang or whatever created us that way, one should think it was for something good. But it seems to take us in all the wrong directions to finishing off this planet somehow and ourselves. Anyway, I think, Andy, will you start off on that? Is it the essence of being human that we think?
Yeah, I'd say I want to be, I want to be nice to thought on this level in that, I suppose it's so tempting because with Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, you get this idea that thought is what makes us superior. We're rational, unlike the animals, and that's what kind of elevates us. That's our primary function in the world. That's what makes us good and virtuous. And I suppose it's tempting to sort of flip that to say thought is actually what's made us fallen. And the animals are better than us, and thought is this great curse. I think it's much more somewhere in the middle. I don't think it drives our lives as much as the Greeks thought it did. I think we're much more ruled by our central nervous system or our stomach or the temperature in the room or our society or whatever. I don't
so
know.
You'll still be human even if you don't contemplate the world.
well, there's this this wonderful story in Thinking Fast and Slow, where he talks about parole board judges who make decisions about whether to release people from prison. And they are more likely to say no the further they are from their last meal.
I think that's interesting. We are going to jump on this and we don't have time, but that's sure. An interesting thought. So, Steve, what do you think about, will thought always be what defines us as human beings?
I hope not. I hope eventually we'll move into a space where we transcend thought, not transcend it, but when we use it as a tool, like I said before, when we transcend that kind of associational chatter which dominates our lives. And that associational chatter, it's the source of a lot of discord in society, a lot of resentment, a lot of aggression. Depression as well is caused by this kind of thought chatter that moves from our minds. So I think if we could get into that space where we don't think, when if we have an empty space of time where we don't need to focus, don't need to be practical, we can get into a space where we don't have to think, where we can just be. I think human beings are probably the most misnamed species on the planet because we don't spend much time being.
Yeah, but is that a problem like just of modern cultures, or so you think that inherently human beings would be able to just be like any other animals, so it's a cultural issue more than it's a
I think it's psychological. I think this kind of thought, the stream of thought that runs through our minds, is a kind of a bit of an aberration, really. It doesn't really serve much function, and it causes a lot of difficulty in our lives. So I think at some point, you know, because it does cause a lot of social problems as well. I think a lot of wars in the world are related to past resentments and grudges. A lot of arguments are based on resentments and grudges. A lot of fear of the future is based on thinking. So if we could let go of that and just learn to be, let's just learn to live in the present moment, then life would become much richer and much more harmonious.
Right. So, and what do you make of this? Is thought the defining quality of being human, Miranda?
In terms of what's been mentioned already, I feel like I sit somewhere in between with an appreciation of thoughtlessness and appreciation of thought. I struggle with the concept that human beings are defined by thought, because I wonder where the line is, where thought starts. And I wonder, for someone who's born with something that means they can't form a thought as we understand it, you know, they're not human. And we say that animals don't have thoughts, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not a scientist. But I think there are definitely kind of, it's blurry, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I don't know exactly what I would say is the defining quality of being human. But I do think what we need to struggle with as human beings is to find the balance between thought and thoughtlessness. And when I say thoughtlessness, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean thought-free states.
Yeah.
There's kind of health potentially in both of them.
I think also we need to differentiate between the thoughts that stay with you, like how you deal with your surroundings or whether it's cold or warm and you need to go somewhere. So, because also animals do think about that. If a cat chases a mouse and he sits waiting for it to come out of its hole, there's thoughts in that. There's a lot of thought going on within animal behavior, but it's not this external contemplation of the world, as I understand it at least. And I think that's also linked to the distraction. You know, you go out. So is it this chatter, this distractive thought, is that part of an essence of being human, or is it something we can get rid of totally?
I'm going to stand with Steve on this one. I think it's a layer.
It's a layer.
On top of us.
And you were on that, and Andy. Is this kind of the layer of thinking that's like chatter and distraction, is it part of our definition of us as human beings, or can we actually get rid of it?
I haven't been able to get rid of it.
Okay.
But
maybe you're not
human. But a better man could.
Okay. a better Andy could. I think on this, if we all became better, we would get rid of our distractive thoughts. So, and let's thank this excellent panel on seduction of thoughts. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, articles, and more from the world's leading thinkers.